President Obama speaks out in Europe today, Wednesday, March 26. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Brussels today, President Obama tried to rally America's European allies against Russian encroachment. But not everyone sees Obama's trip as proof of a pivot to Europe.
Pivot to Europe? No. America's strategic interests are in the Asia-Pacific. There's no doubt about this.
Also, a reporter who reached out to Joseph Stalin's daughter recalls an unexpected twist.
First, I was just interviewing her about her life, and then we kind of became friends, and she was telling me how to raise my children.
And the man behind Ivan's Slurp Shops in Tokyo comes home to New York, but misses his ramen noodles.
I just yearned for ramen. It became this crazy thing where I would just die. I was jonesing for ramen all the time.
And that's why there's a new Slurp Shop in New York.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-mile run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. President Obama's trip to Europe this week has been all about Russia. The president has tried to rally our European allies to form a united front against Moscow's annexation of Crimea. He also warned Russia not to do the same elsewhere. Today, Obama felt the need to remind Europeans that freedom isn't free and urged them to reverse cuts in defense spending. This was during a visit to a U.S. war cemetery in Belgium. Later, in Brussels, he again condemned Moscow for its actions in Crimea.
Russia's leadership is challenging truths that only a few weeks ago seemed self-evident. That in the 21st century, the borders of Europe cannot be redrawn with force. That international law matters. That people and nations can make their own decisions about their future.
President Obama speaking earlier today in Brussels. Judy Dempsey is a senior associate with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Europe. So that's a lot of bold talk there, Judy, but really what can be done?
Actually, very little. The most extraordinary thing is that this is President Obama's first visit to Brussels since becoming president. So that says a lot about what he thinks of Brussels. But in terms of the content of the speech, very nice rhetoric, trying to rally the troops, literally trying to rally NATO to spend more on defense, and trying to rally the Europeans and sort of strengthen their backbone when it comes to Russia. But I'm not so sure this rhetoric will get this far. The Europeans have been united up to a certain level, but they haven't been as forceful as the United States has been when it comes to dealing with Putin.
You know, the White House made this famous pivot to Asia, but it kind of feels like it's now pivoting to Europe. Are they going to get what they want?
The White House isn't going to pivot to Europe.
This doesn't feel like a pivot to Europe for you?
No. I mean, why should they? Europe is prosperous. Europe, after 50 years, should be able to look after its defense and its security. Of course, there'll be a kind of boost for NATO because the Americans will have quote-unquote, rediscovered NATO. But pivot to Europe, no. America's strategic interests are in the Asia-Pacific. There's no doubt about this. There will be gestures made, some gestures in NATO, bolstering the air defenses for the Baltic states, maybe some more exercises, maybe helping Ukraine restructure its armed forces. But Europe is too wealthy, too prosperous, too stable to justify a re-pivot. We cannot go back to the status quo ante, which is actually the Cold War, when the Europeans completely depended on the United States. I mean, Obama didn't say what he should have said. And what he should have said was, look, if you want the transatlantic relationship to survive and to prosper, look after your security. We will help you if needed, but look after your whole defense spending and where your interests are. And he didn't say this. You know, it's time that the Americans laid it down on the line that their strategic interests have completely changed.
Judy Dempsey with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Europe. Thanks so much for your thoughts.
Big pleasure.
The thorny relationship between Moscow and Washington goes way back, of course, and the thorns definitely left a mark on the life of Svetlana Aleluyeva. She was the daughter of Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin. Aleluyeva defected to the U.S. in 1967, but then she bounced back and forth between the two countries. In this week's New Yorker magazine, Nicholas Thompson writes about his long friendship with Aleluyeva. The two got to know each other when Thompson was writing a book about the former U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union, George Kennan. In 2006, Thompson sent a letter to Stalin's daughter, who was then living in Wisconsin.
Very quickly, I got this long, incredible letter from her with wild handwriting, and it looked very confused, and I opened it up and was startled. And then I started to read the letter, and I realized just how bright, sharp, and interesting she was. And so then we started to write. First, I was just interviewing her about George Kennan, and then I was just kind of interviewing her about her life. And then we kind of became friends, and she was telling me how to raise my children.
So George Kennan, this kind of super diplomat, what do you think he understood about her that a lot of people at the time did not?
This is the daughter of the woman who had expelled him from Moscow. This was a woman who it was hard to imagine even really existed. Like, Stalin has a daughter, and she's this interesting, engaging woman who wants to come to America. So he, as a Russian scholar, was, of course, fascinated by the idea of her. And then he met her, and he was a very deep-thinking, insightful man, and he also was somewhat protective, and so he kind of took her under his wing when she came to America, and they became very good friends, and they would talk a lot. They would talk about Russia. They would talk about American politics, and they became very close. And he also wasn't someone who would just let go, and so when she started to eviscerate him or scream at him or blame him for all the problems in her life, he would respond calmly and try to talk her back and try to reconnect the friendship. So they exchanged letter after letter for 20 years.
In the current context of Crimea and all this seemingly sudden misunderstanding between Russia and the U.S., who are you? Who are you? She's almost like a symbol or an emblem of this misunderstanding. What has it told you about how Russians and Americans talk to or past one another right now?
Well, in the context of the current misunderstandings between Russia and the United States, she's a very interesting case study because she's someone who grew up during a period when there was the most dramatic hostility you can possibly imagine between the United States and Russia. And yet there she was on the inside of the Kremlin, yearning for the United States, yearning for the freedom of the United States, yearning for the democracy of the United States, frustrated with the system of the Soviet Union. And then she comes to America. And she's in this country. And after a little while, she starts to yearn to go back home. And so in the mid-80s, she defects back to the Soviet Union, or sort of undefects, and returns to the Soviet Union. And then she gets there, and she says, my gosh, I can't be here. I need to go back to the United States. She sees a woman who's constantly bouncing between these two countries, unsure of where she really fits in, and unsure of what really is home. Ultimately, she sort of decided that America is a better place for her than Russia or the Soviet Union. But she is a fascinating case study at this time where, once again, we have incredible misunderstandings between us and Russia.
So let me take another leap here. Does having had this friendship with her kind of alter your view, or at least kind of give you some slice of insight into why diplomacy is so fraught between our two nations?
Well, a little bit. I mean, it helped me understand a little bit about the way people view the Soviet state. So she, she was incredibly paranoid about Putin. And she thought that Putin was constantly spying on her. She thought that Putin had all these incredibly malicious motives. She said, look, you don't understand Russian leaders. You know, they are paranoid, they are nationalistic, and they're going to come and get me. At one point, I was going to Russia to do some reporting. She said, oh, beware, you're going to be kidnapped. Terrible things will happen to you. The KGB is everywhere. And I said, oh, you know, Svetlana, don't worry about it. Things are fine now. It's okay. I'm just going to go there. I'll report my story. It will be all right. Later on, there was a woman who did an interview with her in her apartment, and then Svetlana became convinced that the woman had been a spy for Putin, and so Svetlana moved apartments. So I'm not sure whether she's the most insightful analyst of Putin. I think that she clearly probably thought of him as far more paranoid than he actually is. But it's also the case that Putin's actions in recent weeks and recent months have suggested a fierce Russian nationalism and a dislike of the West that Svetlana surely would have predicted.
Nicholas Thompson, editor of thenewyorker.com, thanks for telling us about this. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Here's something Stalin probably never had to contend with. Kids climbing to the top of skyscrapers just for the fun of it. It's become an especially popular pastime in the Russian industrial city of Novosibirsk. Last month, two kids from there made international headlines after they climbed the Shanghai Tower in China. Now, Novosibirsk is going through a building boom, with cranes and half-finished apartment buildings crowding the sky. And that's made it a playground for so-called roofers, as Ashley Cleek found out.
Nikolai Konyev walks straight up to the door of a newish 20-story apartment building. He pulls out a magnetic door key about the size of a coat button and inserts it into a magnetic lock. But the metal door doesn't open. Nikolai blows on the key and tries again. This time, the intercom beeps, letting us in. Nikolai is soft-spoken, with a slight lisp and curly strawberry blonde hair. He looks like a college kid coming home to his parents. But Nikolai doesn't live here.
Universal intercom keys. They are best friends of Lufa.
We take the elevator to the 17th floor, one floor shy of the top. Nikolai doesn't want the guards watching the elevator to think he's headed to the roof. Then we go up some stairs. At the top of the stairs is a heavy iron gate. Nikolai scans it, shakes it. It won't budge. He pauses for a second to think. And we're off to another rooftop. This is called roofing. The English word has been co-opted by young Russians to mean anyone who sneaks onto rooftops. And it's really popular. You can find hundreds of photos online of Russian kids standing on tiptoes on the railing of a roof, balancing on the arm of a construction crane, or basking in the sun atop a Moscow skyscraper. Nikolai says when he was younger, he's 19, he used to climb drain pipes, rusty ladders, dangle his feet over icy ledges. Crazy stuff. But not anymore.
I'm scared to stand on slippery places. I used to do that. I don't really anymore.
But a lot of kids do. And in the past few years, several roofers have died, falling through glass ceilings or slipping off bridges, which roofers also climb to get good photos. And roofing's illegal, though the punishment is really a slap on the wrist, a paltry $14 fine. Some officials are trying to make the punishment for roofing more severe. There's talk of charging roofers with hooliganism, which can involve jail time. But for most roofers, like Nikolai, roofing is worth the risk, whether it's the fine or the danger.
It's hard to explain. The first time I had this feeling that I did something impossible, that the whole city is in the palm of my hand.
Nikolai and his roofer friends have a code. They don't go up on roofs alone. They don't vandalize. They don't drink while climbing. For them, roofs are like massive camera tripods that let them focus on the city.
You can't describe it with words, especially these winter landscapes, like we have here in Siberia, these kinds of sharp evenings. The sky is clean. Landscape painters should come up here.
We get to a second building close to sunset. We get to the top floor. This time, there's a window with no handle, probably to discourage roofers. This happens a lot, and Nikolai's prepared. He roots around in his bag for a spare window handle. He finds the right size and quickly opens the window. And here we are, 23 floors up, in the center of Novosibirsk. Below, the city is lit up by streetlights and the taillights of cars. You have to live in the present, Nikolai says. Then he checks his phone to see when the sunset will be and sets up his camera, facing west. Nikolai says he's bored with the roofs of Novosibirsk. The highest is a measly 27 floors. He'd like to visit bigger cities. Like Icarus from Greek mythology, Nikolai wants to get as high as possible. Though, of course, without getting burned. For The World, I'm Ashley Cleek, in Novosibirsk, Russia.
We've got some of Nikolai's stunning Novosibirsk photos and that gut-churning video from the Shanghai Tower. Bet you can't watch it until the end. That's all at PRI.org. Still ahead, Radiohead meets Sudan on The World from PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It was a lesson in humility for the Japanese soccer team Urawa Red Diamonds. This past Sunday, the team was ordered to play in an empty stadium as punishment for allowing fans to put up a Japanese-only banner in the stands. The sign, written in English, was meant to discourage foreigners from sitting in a particular section. The punishment resulted in not just losing an audience, but possibly losing more than $1 million in ticket sales. Kirk Spitzer lives in Tokyo and writes for Time magazine. So the fans put up these banners. Why is the team punished?
Well, the team was expected to have taken those banners down right away. Now, the team management says that they learned about the banner being put up about an hour into the game. They said that they did not deem this to be racist or discriminatory or in any way derogatory towards foreigners, so they left it up. You know, given the context of a lot of concerns in Japan about rising nationalism and anti-foreign sentiments, this was considered to be quite shocking to people when it went when photos and video was posted online. It went viral, as you can imagine, and the team got quite a bit of criticism over this.
And so can you tell us who goes to these soccer games?
Mostly middle-class Japanese. It's considered to be much more of a family-oriented sport than you would find, say, in Europe or elsewhere in Asia. Usually not a whole lot of anti-foreign sentiment. Essentially zero hooliganism that you would find other places. It's a good, solid middle-class sport.
So who might have these fans been talking about with these banners?
The fans say that basically that it really wasn't meant in any kind of racist or derogatory way. They simply didn't want any foreigners sitting in their section who might not understand the group cheers and might not participate. Now, this is actually a pretty thin excuse. The team, when they investigated afterwards, didn't accept it, and they banned this particular group, about 20 or so people. But it's also true that after the game was over, a number of security officers said that they did hear what they said were discriminatory statements towards foreigners that was coming from the stands. So this was something that does have people here quite concerned.
So Japan is qualified for the World Cup in Brazil this summer. Will officials address racism with fans and players before they land in this? You know, it's a very diverse country, which will be hosting an even more diverse array of nationalities.
Well, that's a very good question. I'm sure they will, or they had better. A group of Japanese fans, in fact, about a year ago during a game in Korea between the Japanese national team and the Korean national team, a group of Japanese fans were waving very, very large Japanese World War II flags, the Kyokujitsuki. You've probably seen them, the flags with the red rising sun banner on a white background. And this was very, very inflammatory to the Koreans, who, of course, were occupied by the Japanese for many, many years. So these particular fans were heavily criticized for that. So I'm sure that the authorities here will remind everyone to be on their very best behavior when they go to Brazil.
Kirk Spitzer with Time magazine speaking with us from Tokyo. Thank you very much.
Marco, you're welcome.
You know who's big in Japan? Ivan Orkin. He's famous for his two very popular ramen slurp shops in Tokyo. He recently opened a third one in New York. So how exactly did the self-described real American guy wind up making ramen noodles in Japan? Well, turn the clock back to 1978. Orkin was 15 years old and growing up on Long Island. A Japanese restaurant opened up there, the first in town. They needed help, and Ivan got the call.
I took the job. And it must have been like one of my first days there. And I mean, remember, I'm 15 years old. I'm hungry all the time. So I come through the door and I'm like dizzy with hunger. And I said to the chef, you know, I'm starving. Can I have something to eat? And so he pulls out a bowl and he fills it with rice and he takes another bowl and he cracks her egg in it and he whips it up with his chopsticks and he adds a little soy sauce and he pours it over the hot steaming rice and he sprinkles some nori on top. And he sort of thrusts it into my hand, and I'm sort of like, I've got a bowl of steaming hot raw egg on top of some rice. But anyway, I ate it, and it was creamy, and it was, you know, a little fishy from the little like the sea flavored from the nori, and I was like, you know, I like this. This is good. And after that, I was sort of invited to eat everything, raw squid stomachs and livers and tuna and all that stuff, and I became sort of one of the gang. And I only had that job for a year, but that sort of, you know, I not only fell in love with Japanese food, which for, I guess, a lot of people, that would have been the end of the story. I started to love Japanese food after that job. But I also really liked the people. They were very kind to me. They sort of took care of me, and I was impressed. I graduated college with a degree in Japanese, And so it seemed like it made sense to just move to Japan. And a lot of my friends who had majored in Japanese or Chinese, it was sort of a tight-knit Asian department, were moving to their respective countries of study. So, you know, when I flew into Narita Airport in Tokyo, my memory is that as the wheels touched on the tarmac, I felt like I was coming home. It was really cool. Like I said, I have this memory, this feeling of just feeling very happy and really comfortable and feeling like, wow, you know, this is where I belong. So when I moved to Japan, you know, I started to eat ramen. I really loved it. I would slurp bowls all the time, and I was really into it. And then I moved back to New York. And in New York, you could eat yakitori, you could eat great sushi, you could drink pretty good sake. There was a lot of good stuff in the 90s, but there was really no ramen. And so I just yearned for ramen. It became this crazy thing where I would just die. I was jonesing for ramen all the time, and I couldn't have it. So when we finally moved back, you know, 13 years later, all I did was eat ramen. And my wife, you know, we had this on the cell phone, there was this thing called the Ramen Navi. It was a sort of an app. And you could go into this app, and I would be driving everywhere. My wife would have the cell phone flipped open. This is when there were flip phones, not iPhones. And she would, you know, be looking. She'd go, okay, turn right here and turn left there and go down that tiny little road. And all of a sudden we'd see people all lined up and we'd park and we'd run and we'd eat a bowl of ramen. And we would just, and we were eating it like, you know, 2, 3, 4 days a week. So I decide to open the ramen shop, and we find this little spot, 10 little seats, you know, rickety doors, you know, it was really cool. It was just, I mean, it's a real Japanese joint. And my wife, so the day we open, my wife sends an anonymous letter to this famous ramen critic. You know, hey, I hear there's this, you know, this white guy making ramen, and I went in and I tried it, and you know what, it was pretty good, you should check it out, or something like that. And so the next day, he shows up. He sort of walks in, and he sits down, and he slurps his bowl, and then he stands up all of a sudden. He starts asking me questions in really fast Japanese. And this is the first week. I'm dripping with sweat. I'm freaking out. So the guy starts talking to me, and I'm like, and I couldn't catch what he said. And he just sort of said, oh, like, I guess you don't really understand Japanese. And he sort of walked out. But then, like, that week, he wrote on his blog, you know, hey, I went to Ivan Ramen, a new ramen shop run by this American, and you know what? It was really good.
Ivan Orkin, a.k.a. Ivan Ramen. He spoke to producer Alex Galifant in New York. You may now slurp openly. This is The World on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, Kwai Kwarte uses his homeland of Ghana as the backdrop for his stories about detective hero Darko Dawson. Darko's a tough guy with a heart of gold, but can he save Ghana from going down the tubes?
I doubt it. But if that does happen, we know there'll be a murder in there somewhere. Darko will be there to solve it.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Investigators trying to solve the mystery of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 are hoping, more than anything, for one thing, the discovery of the plane's flight recorders. You know, the black boxes that record flight data and the pilots' voices. Never mind that they're not actually painted black or that the technology in them is decades old. Clive Irving is a contributor at The Daily Beast and the senior consulting editor at Condé Nast Traveler. So why in 2014 do we still rely on 1960s technology to rescue missing planes?
Well, I got first interested in this in the case of the Air France Flight 447, which went down into the Atlantic. And then I realized that there was a disjunction between the technology that was available and the technology that was being used. There always seems to be a lag in the adoption of new technology in aviation. And part of the reason for that is that it's a safety issue, that things have to be rigorously tested. But in this case, that was not the case. So what we're actually doing is we're using VCR technology in the age of Netflix, but with another difference is that we take the VCR and we throw it into the ocean and then set off and try to find it. But as I said, in the case of the Air France thing, what struck me was not just that there was that the technology was there to avoid this, but I asked a simple question: could we get through live streaming directly from the plane in real time the same amount of information, and what's more important, the same quality of information that you can get from a flight recorder? And that, this is now 5 years ago, and I was told, yes, that's possible. So then I asked, well, why isn't it being done? And they said, well, it's going to cost. And then people, when you mount an argument like this for change like this, you get people coming in blinding you with science.
What do you think are the simple fixes to the black box that ought to happen right now?
Well, I mean, the black box, I think, should be abandoned, because, you know, what could be more crazy than all the essential evidence relating to a crash going down with the plane? I mean, that is really crazy.
I mean, given cloud technology, how hard would it be to have all of these kind of data points going on in the plane, including conversations between the pilots, somewhere up in the cloud?
Yeah, that's entirely possible. I hope this time, I think this is an exceptional event. I think what's going on now is that there's such public amazement that this isn't going on, that public amazement in itself becomes a political force, that those in whose hands this rests, a mixture of airline industry bureaucrats, airline industry, airline owners, airline regulators spread over the world who've so far resisted this. The Europeans, after that Air France crash, the Europeans ran a series of simulated, nearly 600 simulated crashes in which they used this live streaming method as an alternative. And they found out that in 85% of those cases, the information could have been retrieved as effectively as if it were in the black box. And this is even more significant in view of the Malaysia thing. In 82% of those cases, they would have been able to locate where the plane went down with an accuracy of within 4 miles.
Wow. So what's holding everything back?
Well, I think we need to scream loudly and widely. There is the people in London at Inmarsat, whose satellite was the one last remaining link with this aircraft that went disappearing. They had those pings. They have been saying this week themselves they are amazed that it should get down to that one thing, and they cannot understand either why this technology, which is readily available right now, why it's not been done.
Clive Irving, a contributor at The Daily Beast and the senior consulting editor at Condé Nast Traveler, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Add Taiwan to the list of places where students have taken to the streets to protest. The students are angry at the government for trying to push a trade agreement through parliament. The agreement is with mainland China, which Taiwan split from decades ago. And the students say the pact would increase Beijing's economic leverage on Taiwan. Last week, the students occupied parliament to put pressure on the government, and they're still there. Ketty Chen is a visiting professor at National Taiwan University, and she's been following the protests.
The occupation of the legislature was seen as the last straw, as the National Chinese Party leaders unilaterally announced that the service trade agreement had been reviewed and sent to the floor for voting. And the students came out because they thought that this was the direct infringement of Taiwan's democracy. They were not happy about that.
Okay, so the students have been upset about this for over a year, and now they've taken over the legislature. Why now? What happened?
The students have been protesting the lack of transparency when the agreement was signed.
So students basically feel that a process was not followed.
It's not so much in protesting free trade agreement or economic ties with China, but also mostly the lack of democratic procedural justice. So you cannot just say that these are anti-free trade protesters. Also, citizens who are extremely concerned with Taiwan's democracy being infringed upon.
Is there also some disappointment in the Taiwanese government that they are cozying up economically with mainland China?
Approximately 900,000 firms in Taiwan are service-oriented businesses, and 99% of the serviced businesses are medium and small enterprises, and even 85% being micro enterprises, which means they have less than 5 employees. So their scale is much smaller than Chinese enterprises. So with the signing of the agreement, the demonstrator really felt that the government wasn't really watching out for their interest.
What's been the reaction from government officials in Taiwan to the student protests and the takeover of the parliament?
The opposition legislators have been sitting outside of the legislature doors to try to make sure that the police do not rough up the students. On the opposite side, the ruling party had been very critical of the students, calling them undemocratic, condemning them of the way that they climbed over the fence and entered the windows of the legislature, calling them disrespectful, all kinds of things.
Meantime, I hear academics and professors in Taiwan are siding with the students. I mean, you're a visiting professor at National Taiwan University. What have you been hearing from the teachers?
Teachers are also split, but a lot of the professors are coming out and in support of the students. And a lot of them are taking their classes outside of the legislative yuan, especially the social sciences professors. 52 university presidents signed a petition urging the government to resolve the issue with the students and also calling the government to respect Taiwan's democracy and the students' right to protest.
It sounds pretty dramatic. Where is all this headed?
Yesterday, the president had expressed willingness to speak to the students and trying to resolve the issue. And the head of the legislature, Chairperson Wang Jingping, also held meetings between all the political party leaders. So you see that the government is trying to resolve the problems and trying to make amends with the students. But right now, the students are saying that the government was insincere in the fact that the venue of the meeting was not being arranged, and the president still is exerting pressure on the legislators of his party to try to get the agreement passed. So I really don't know how long the occupation will be, but I'm looking forward to the resolution of such issue.
Katie Chen, a visiting professor at National Taiwan University, talking to us about the student protests that have taken over the parliament there. Thanks very much, Katie. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
There are no easy ways to talk about the ongoing crisis in the Central African Republic. In the past few weeks, a truly horrifying situation in CAR has gotten even worse. Thousands have been killed in what the United Nations describes as ethnic religious cleansing. Hundreds of thousands have been forced to flee for their lives. Behind the wave of violence, machete-wielding Christian militias known as the Antibalaka. They've been killing Muslims in revenge for abuses by predominantly Muslim militias last year. Peter Bouquert is with Human Rights Watch. He just returned from a 10-day trip to CAR.
It's really quite an unprecedented crisis for the country. Almost the entire Muslim population of the western part of the country and the capital Bangui have now fled to Chad and Cameroon and the two neighboring Congos. Literally, we were going through towns and had them completely emptied out of their Muslim population. Not a single Muslim left in many of the towns we visited.
And the level of violence apparently is also pretty unprecedented as far as you saw with your own eyes.
Yes, I mean, one of the most shocking parts of this crisis is just how every Muslim has been targeted by the Antibalaka militias in their attacks against the Muslim community, which come in revenge for what Seleka, the mostly Muslim rebel group which took power just a year ago, did while they were ruling. But we've just documented shocking cases of violence against children. Just 2 weeks ago, I was with a little boy of 12 years old, who had been left for dead by the Antibalaka. He lost his arm in a machete attack. And when his mother tried to plea for his life, the Antibalaka said, no, we have to kill somebody.
And did they explain why they feel that way? Why do they have to kill somebody?
Well, I think we have to understand that the origins of this crisis are the 10 months of absolute terror that the majority Christian population suffered at the hands of the mostly Muslim Seleka rebels. And this explosion of violence really is in response to what the Seleka did.
I mean, despite the hopelessness over the weeks that you were there in CAR, I followed your Twitter feed and you documented some of these horrors, but you also came across moments of humanity, of hope amid the mayhem and violence. Maybe you can just tell us about some of the kind of more encouraging signs that you saw while you were there.
Yes. one of the most touching moments on our last trip, which was my fourth trip to the country in just 4 months, happened in a town called Bosom Tele, about 200 miles north of the capital, Bangui. We passed through there about 2 weeks ago on a Saturday, and they still had 280 Muslims left. And when we returned 2 days later on Monday, there were only about 60 or so left. The rest had fled on commercial trucks, but they had left behind at the Catholic mission the weakest, including 10 handicapped children and many women and young children who just weren't strong enough to climb on these big trucks. And it was a very sad moment to see the weakest abandoned at the Catholic mission. But at the same time, the Catholic priest there was an absolutely inspiring figure. He said, "It doesn't matter that they've been abandoned. We will look after them like our own children. And they are my children."
You know, it strikes me, I'm a non-African in Boston. You're a non-African in London. You have been to CAR, but we're discussing this country. Is there someone in Africa who's trying to get the international community focused on what's happening in CAR?
Absolutely. The crisis in the Central African Republic has reverberated especially strong in Rwanda, which went through similar horror just 20 years ago. This month is the anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda, and Rwanda has sent many peacekeeping troops to the country to try to end the killings, and they have been among the most courageous soldiers on the ground. I meet with them almost every day. What they see in front of their eyes does bring back many dark memories of what happened 20 years ago in Rwanda. It is a very different situation, but certainly the horrific violence reminds many of what happened 20 years ago.
Peter Boukert with Human Rights Watch, who's just come back from Central African Republic. Thanks very much for your thoughts.
Thank you.
The Nile doesn't pass through the Central African Republic, but it's not far away. Its waters flow through neighboring Sudan and South Sudan. All told, the Nile and its tributaries stretch from Ethiopia and Uganda all the way to Egypt's Mediterranean coast. That's a lot of territory, much of it troubled territory right now, but that hasn't stopped a group of musicians from focusing on the cultural and environmental links that connect people up and down the Nile. And while their Nile project doesn't erase a host of problems, it's definitely giving people in the region food and music for thought.
Right now, after the Uganda residency, I have more ideas than I know what to do with.
That's Mekleet Hedero, an Ethiopian-born, San Francisco-based jazz singer. She and Egyptian ethnomusicologist Mina Girgis launched the Nile Project. The idea was to use music to explore the challenges all the countries along the river face. Hedero says it sparked conversations up and down the Nile, although she admits the audience at a concert last year in Egypt didn't seem to understand what the point was at first.
You could kind of sense the skepticism of the audience, you know. What is this going to be? Another, you know, NGO music, something like that? Because people have experience with music that's created by NGOs that ends up telling you what to think about something. But by the time the concert ended, the audience was on their feet, cheering, yelling. They said we'd never heard anything like this before, and afterwards they wouldn't let us go.
One fringe benefit for Mekleet Hedero, the Nile Project has also informed her new album.
The title track, We Are Alive, is based on a Sudanese rhythm that I learned in the Nile Project residency. It's a 5-count rhythm called the camel walk from eastern Sudan. So that was taught to me by Ahmed Said, one of the Nile Project musicians. So I couldn't get that rhythm out of my physicality. And I wrote that song, We Are Alive, based both on that rhythm as well as on a Radiohead 5-count that I also had kind of obsessed over.
In times I never had enough, a hole in what I needed, I broke.
Radio Radiohead and the Nile, channeled by singer Maclete Hedero. That's global jazz for you. And this is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Here's a fast-flowing geo-quiz for you now, presented for you today by Taylor Hawes, who works for the Nature Conservancy.
Can you tell me the name of the river that starts up in Wyoming and travels 1,400 miles, passes through seven U.S. states and into Mexico, and is being celebrated for an agreement between the two countries that includes environmental benefits for the first time ever?
Yeah, the delta of that river will be flooding this week for the first time in years, so think fast. Okay, one Mississippi, two Mississippi, three Mississippi, or perhaps more to the point, one Colorado, two Colorado, because that's the answer, of course. It's a mighty Colorado, the river that carved out the Grand Canyon over millions of years. Much more recently, the Colorado's been drained by irrigation or stopped in its tracks by dams. Barely a drop reaches the river's delta in Mexico anymore. But just a few days ago, U.S. and Mexican officials released a massive pulse of water from Lake Mead in Nevada, and the flood is now rushing south toward the Colorado Delta. Taylor Hawes says the idea is to mimic the seasonal surges of years past.
The pulse flow is supposed to emulate a flood. So in the spring, and we get these spring floods, and they help restore the environment and help trees, you know, bloom and kind of move seeds around. And so this is part of a larger agreement between the U.S. and Mexico that includes a lot of other benefits for farmers in Mexico and water for the Delta, which has not seen water regularly since the 1960s when Lake Powell was finished.
Hawes says the artificial flood is an experiment in both river restoration and U.S.-Mexico cooperation.
We've so overused the Colorado River throughout the U.S. and Mexico that no water makes it to the Delta anymore, and so the Delta has dried up. There are a few pockets where there's healthy cottonwoods and willows for birds, but this region, it's been reduced to about, you know, 10% of its former size. And so we're just trying to make sure that there's healthy forest for birds and wildlife in this region. But we have to do it, you know, a little bit creatively than we would if Mother Nature were doing it herself.
Hawes says right now the water is seeping more than surging, but by the weekend, she says the flow should be enough for scientists to raft along a stretch near the international border. And in a few more days, they're hoping the Colorado might flow all the way to its mouth at the Gulf of California for the first time in years.
It just chokes me up to see this river that has not been through this area in more than 17 years kind of working its way to the ocean like it was, you know, meant to do. Just seeing a river getting to be a river again, and I think, you know, I just want to really celebrate it.
That's Taylor Hawes of the Nature Conservancy speaking with us from Yuma, Arizona, near the banks of the Colorado River. The experimental flood is so far a one-shot deal, but it's possible that it could be repeated under the new water treaty between the U.S. and Mexico. Finally today, we enter a world created by Ghanaian-American author Kwe Kwarte. He's got a mystery series set in Ghana. That's where intrepid gumshoe Darko Dawson earns his keep in the rough-and-tumble local police force. The third installment in the series features Big Oil and, of course, a killing. A few of them, in fact. The book is called Murder at Cape Three Points.
Cape Three Points is just acres and acres and acres of beautiful forest. It's very lush green because the western region in which Takoradi is has the highest rainfall in the country. And the coast itself is just gorgeous with these plunging cliffs and rocky shores, beautiful teal green ocean. Dolphins and whales pass through the area. Just an achingly lovely area. And I guess one of the things I tackle in my novel is what happens when people want to make use of this area for, you know, real estate developments, luxury hotels, and the like.
I happened to travel there many years ago when Jerry Rawlings was president, and it was beautiful. But in the 80s, it was pretty economically downtrodden. There was no industry, little revenue to speak of. It didn't look like the country you describe in your novel. So what happened?
Takoradi, which is the third largest city and is in the general location of the oil discovery, although obviously it's several miles offshore, is now the boom town. So We have as many as 23 new banks coming into town. We have probably the largest hotel in Ghana, the Atlantic Hotel. So we just have an influx of lots of supportive industries for the oil industry. It's just an amazing transformation. Already, of course, you can see the adverse effects. For example, there's lots of different types of conflict between, for example, the environmentalists and the oil companies.
When was the last time you went back to Ghana and visited this area?
February of 2014, and then before that, I'd been there in August of 2013. And then I also went on an oil rig itself called the West Leo oil rig about 38 miles offshore.
Yeah, I mean, you give Darko Dawson in your novel that experience of flying out there. It sounds pretty intense.
Flying out there was really a wonderful experience. Getting trained for it was a totally different matter, since you have to undergo what's called a helicopter underwater escape training, which is a little bit harrowing. And so Darko goes through that in the novel, and I felt it was only fair that I go through it myself.
For you, I mean, what happened in that underwater training?
What happens is you wear a breathing apparatus. They get you used to being halfway in the water. And then the final stage is to immerse the cabin completely in water and then flip it over 180 degrees. And then you have to get out by pushing your window out and escaping to the surface. And the mistake I made was to forget what they said. You must keep your landmarks, your elbow at your window and your hand on your seatbelt. I think I just totally got so disoriented and freaked. Then I completely lost my bearings and got a little bit panicked. I mean, I'm happy to say that I did it sort of on the third attempt I did it, but it was very disorienting. Darko did a lot better than I did in the novel, and Darko can't even swim, so it is a little embarrassing.
Well, that's why you're a doctor and a writer, not a helicopter pilot. Now, you're a fictional police detective, Darko Dawson. He's such a man of integrity, doesn't cheat on his wife despite his desires. He manages not to take even a little hit of weed or marijuana now and then. Can he single-handedly keep Ghana from going down the tubes and becoming a smaller version of Nigeria?
I doubt it. But if that does happen, we know there'll be a murder in there somewhere. And Darko will be there to solve it.
And you'll be writing about it, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, Darko takes the lead, and I just chronicle his adventures.
Kwe Kwarte, the author of Murder at Cape Three Points, thanks very much for your time. Great to talk to you.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
A little Ghanaian palm wine music will do it for us today. I tweet at Marco Werman. The world tweets at PRI The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. Thanks for tuning in.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org. The Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at RitaAllen.org. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.